This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
Support for this public radio podcast comes from the Society for Human Resource Management, which also sponsors PBS's CEO Exchange, online at shrm.org. Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, managing money since 1937 with a focus on consistent results over the long term. Putnam Investments, a prudent approach to investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
All right, let's see now. I'm saving for a new camera. The kids' college funds could use a contribution or two. What are you going to do with your $600? I don't know if you've heard, but the government is giving money away. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Constellation Energy, working to provide responsible, sustainable energy to power America's future. Constellation Energy, the way energy works. Marketplace Entrepreneurship Reporting is supported by Lenovo, official computer partner of the Olympic Games. Lenovo dedicates 1% of income to support entrepreneurship and social ventures worldwide.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is Thursday today, the 24th of January, and it is great to have you here. Congressional Democrats and Treasury Secretary Henry Paulson did everything but hand out actual checks today. They lined up at a press conference to announce a deal for the much-ballyhooed economic stimulus package. John Q. Public can expect a hefty refund from the IRS this spring, and he'll have an easier time getting a home loan, too. Whether or not that helps avoid a recession, well, here's Stacey Vanek Smith.
House Speaker Nancy Pelosi made it very clear today who the stimulus package is supposed to help.
This is a middle class initiative to strengthen the middle class and to those who aspire to be in the middle class.
Working stiffs who bank less than $75,000 a year would get up to $600 back from the tax man, including an additional $300 per child. Businesses would also get tax breaks, and the federal government would back home loans as high as $725,000. But economic consultant Gary Schilling says consumer spending isn't the problem. It's the banks that really need help.
It's the financial area where the problem lies, and I just don't see these rebate checks making much difference to those deep and widespread financial problems.
Schilling says the package could even make things worse by sending out the signal that Washington is panicky. That could hurt investor confidence, but not everybody agrees.
I would like my check, and I think everybody else sort of feels the same way.
David Weiss is chief economist at Standard & Poor's. He says it's important that the government does what it can now, before things get worse.
What you're really doing is borrowing spending from the future and moving it to now. But that helps if you're worried about a temporary dip in the economy. So like filling a pothole, the dirt has to come from somewhere else. But that doesn't mean you shouldn't fill the pothole.
Weiss says Wall Street looks to the government to take action. He points out that the markets responded well to the Federal Reserve's decision to cut interest rates earlier this week. I'm Stacey Vanek Smith for Marketplace.
Not that you needed another opinion on whether we're in a recession or not, but Alan Greenspan chimed in again today. The former Fed chairman says we aren't yet. It's easy to oversimplify as you try to explain something like an interest rate cut, but the news out of Paris this morning does have a certain connect-the-dots quality to it. Société Générale is the second biggest bank in France. It revealed today one of its traders racked up catastrophic losses in fraudulent transactions. The bank tried to undo the damage by selling into a falling market, a market that Ben Bernanke and the rate-cutting Federal Reserve were keeping a close eye on. From the Marketplace European desk in London, Stephen Beard has more.
France's second biggest bank has been humiliated by a junior trader. 31-year-old Jérôme Kerviel made massive bets in the futures market without his managers knowing. He knew how to avoid detection, says analyst Peter Hahn.
Uniquely, this trader had prior work experience in the area that monitored and was the back office. He knew how to beat their system and how to keep betting without being caught.
The bank discovered his secret on Saturday and found unauthorized bets worth $80 billion. The bank unloaded those futures on Monday, just as the markets tanked. The huge sales may have even fueled the downturn in share prices. Nick Leeson, the rogue trader who brought down Barings Bank in 1995, thinks that the French trader was, like him, motivated by fear of failure.
People are working within that fast-paced environment that is so built around, you know, winning and making money. The fear of failure is the thing that, you know, that they just can't confront.
Unlike Barings, the French bank is not going bust, but it has to raise $8 billion in emergency capital. After the subprime crisis, another serious blow to the banking sector. But American bankers may at least derive grim satisfaction from one aspect of the affair. France has always criticized what it calls the excesses of American capitalism. Now, the biggest ever loss incurred by a financial trader has happened in France. In London, this is Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
For all the worries about a slowing U.S. economy, Beijing reported today its gross domestic product jumped 11.4% for all of last year. And Andy Rothman at the brokerage firm CLSA in Shanghai says the Chinese aren't looking back.
What they've managed to do is diversify a lot, so they're no longer as dependent just on the U.S. market as they used to be.
Still, it's not necessarily good news. The Chinese government has been trying like heck to slow its growth. Next time you're in a department store, take a second and browse the skincare area. You might notice the Clinique salespeople are always dressed in white coats. Gives them something of a medical appearance, I guess. Today, Clinique announced it really is moving into the doctor's office. The company is teaming up with Botox maker Allergan for its latest product line. Ashley Melntite reports Clinique has seen a wrinkle in the market it's only too happy to fill.
Clinique and Allergan won't reveal details about their new skincare line. What's clear is that these aren't your usual lotions and potions. They're designed to treat the skin before and after non-surgical treatments like Botox and Restylane. Lynn Green is global president of Clinique. She says the beauty business is changing.
The wrinkle that you have on Tuesday does not have to be there on Wednesday.
Green says Clinique wants to serve customers heading to the dermatologist for a quick fix via a laser or a filler. It's a wise move, says Wendy Liebman, CEO of WSL Strategic Retail.
That has become the sort of efficient way for people to treat their skin instantly. And in some ways, if not careful, it could take business away from the traditional retail brands.
The market for skincare sold through doctors' offices is $238 million and growing fast. Wendy Liebman says more and more women and men pay for non-surgical treatments each year. The cosmetics business, on the other hand, has been struggling lately.
So this is another way to sort of create brands that are much more relevant and building on trends that are already in the marketplace.
She expects other brands to follow Clinique's lead. In New York, I'm Ashley Milne-Tite for Marketplace.
There were no major wrinkles on Wall Street today, all things considered. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. The past 6 months have been a crash course in the finer points of Wall Street maneuvering. We've all learned more than we care to about mortgage-backed securities and special investment vehicles, and the learning curve hasn't flattened out yet. New York's insurance regulator says that on top of all their subprime investments gone bad, investment banks on Wall Street might have to pony up as much as $15 billion to bail out their insurance companies. We've called Marilyn Cohen for a bond insurance primer. She's the president of Envision Capital Management. Marilyn, welcome to the program.
Thank you so much.
Is this just regular old insurance? I mean, that's all we're talking about here, right?
Not even close.
Aha. Okay.
Insurers have been in the business for years of insuring boring old municipal bonds to guarantee the timely interest and principal to the individual investor like you and me who buys municipal bonds because we're in high tax brackets. And if the institution, whether it's a city, state, or water and sewer district, defaults or goes into bankruptcy, then the insurance picks up the interest and principal and flows it through to the investor.
And lo, now we come to the bond market present day, and we've got all these complicated mortgage-backed bonds that have been out there, and still these insurance companies are obliged to provide coverage.
Yes, but they got themselves in big problems because they decided a couple years ago to step out from just boring old municipal insurance. They started insuring some of these more esoteric types of securities called collateralized debt obligations. And they decided, hey, we can get in that business, make a lot of money, slap on our insurance, and voila, we'll take it to the bank.
Let me see if I can lay out a chain of events that might help explain why this is also nerve-wracking for people who follow this stuff. If the mortgages behind these mortgage-backed securities default, as is happening frequently these days,
as we speak,
then the bonds that they are based on default, then these mortgage bond insurers have to pay up. And the problem, of course, here is that the defaults are piling up on defaults, and thus the insurance companies are ever more vulnerable.
Yes, and they don't have the reserves. Obviously, that's why they're talking. The New York head of insurance is talking about, we got to bail these guys out because the reserves aren't there.
All right, but where's that money going to come from? Do I have it right that the banks themselves are going to bail out the insurance companies that are providing them insurance, and it's going to cost maybe $5 billion, maybe more?
Now, isn't that ridiculous? Because the banks bailing them out is ludicrous. You know, this is the way most cycles end. Somebody has to get bailed out. Everybody sues everybody else. And you know what? The only people that are going to make money are going to be the lawyers, you know, sitting off the coast of Costa Rica in their yachts.
I wanted to get down in the weeds a little bit here. You know, banks and institutions have been trading all these insurance obligations back and forth between them. They call them credit default swaps. Isn't that just sort of another layer of what we've had happening with the securitization of all these mortgages? People trading, they don't even know what they're trading?
It is indeed. And people are worried about whether or not the counterparties, either the buyers or the sellers of those insurance swaps, are good for the money. So everybody's putting a big question mark as, who's the ultimate payer?
That's a little scary. Who's the ultimate payer with a question mark?
Well, it's very scary. And, you know, we in the bond market had been predicting this, and you could see that with all what was happening. The equity market, though, all of a sudden woke up and said, my Jove, we've got a problem. So it's a mess. There's no question about it. But we will get over it. We will find solutions as far as raising new capital. We will find solutions as far as bailing out these insurers, even though I think it's despicable. And everybody will lick their wounds and they'll be off to the races after the cycle ends.
Yeah, but how painful is that going to be?
Oh, very painful. Lots of losses out there.
Marilyn Cohen is the president of Envision Capital Management here in Los Angeles. Marilyn, thanks a lot.
My pleasure.
If you're among those who've bought a high-definition television but haven't sprung for an HD package to go with it just yet, you might not have heard of Mojo. Mojo is an HD channel. It's trying to pump up its ratings with some financial flash. Tonight's the first installment of what Mojo's billing as Money Night. It's not talking heads and ticker tape. Teeing up the evening will be a show called Wall Street Warriors. Our New York bureau chief and Wall Street warrior, Jill Barchet, took a look.
The cable network Mojo is calling Wall Street Warriors a docu-money series. But it's more like MTV's Real World meets Wall Street.
How many did you sell?
About 50 so
get
far.
Get 50 more.
I'm going to
go get it done now.
That's Larry Allentoff. He trades orange juice futures, and he's one of the six stars of Wall Street Warriors. The others include a young Ferrari-driving private equity fund manager, an ingenue who's just graduated from college and dreams of her big break, and the stockbrokers who spend the days smiling and dialing.
There's no better feeling than getting a guy on the phone that you really don't know, forcing some stock down his throat, and he ends up buying it.
You do a joint with your wife.
That's what gets me going every day.
Mojo's a fledgling four-year-old network backed by major cable companies, Time Warner, Comcast, and Cox. Sean Skelton is co-producer and director of Wall Street Warriors. He says the network's only available to viewers who pay up for those high-definition cable packages and can afford a $1,000 high-def TV.
A lot of our viewers are Wall Streeters. I'm sure the Wall Streeters like the fact that we're making a show about them. They are a pretty vain crowd.
Mojo's Money Night lineup also includes two new shows, Bobby G, Adventure Capitalist, and Startup Junkies. Bobby Telsiani is a media analyst at Jupiter Research. He says these Wall Street shows brim with tales of financial excess. Just the kind of thing to lure the coveted audience of 20 to 30-year-old men with money.
They're turning away from television. They're turning towards video games. They're turning towards online video and internet activity. So if you can find a television station that reaches them, you can demand a premium advertising rate.
Wall Street is hardly new ground for the networks. Failed attempts include The Street and Bull, two shows which didn't even run a full season in 2000. Now High Finance is back on a roll. The creators of HBO's hit show Entourage are pitching a new series about Wall Street. VH1 recently did a show on fabulous hedge fund traders. And Tulsiani says the cable business networks are targeting these young men with attractive young women and punchy sportscaster-style programming.
You see a guy like Jim Cramer becoming a celebrity. You see another station like Fox Business trying to compete with CNBC.
Fresh from his orange juice trading pit, Wall Street Warriors star Alentov says he's targeting Mojo's young male audience as well as potential investors for his new hedge fund.
The exposure that, you know, the Mojo Network is going to give us, basically I felt would help to launch the hedge fund and raise assets.
Much of this programming was cooked up before the markets went south. Mojo and Alentov have to be hoping young males will be as interested in watching money lost as they are money gained. In New York, I'm Jill Barshay from Marketplace.
Coming up, to stay or to sell, the homeowner's dilemma.
I wouldn't describe it as a decision, as a conversation.
Yeah, that's good, conversation.
The Matrix. We're in the Move Matrix.
But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrials rose 0.8% today, 108 points to close at 12,378. The NASDAQ nudged up 1.9%, 44 points to end at 2360. The S&P 500 hiked up 1%, 13 points there to finish the day at 1352. Lockheed Martin climbed 4%. Union Pacific chugged up 3% today. Both companies beat estimates for the fourth quarter. Xerox printed an 8% gain on news. Its fourth quarter earnings rose 79%. It was all sunshine overseas for a change. London's FTSE pushed up almost 4.75%. France's CAC 40 cranked up 6%. Bond prices fell. The yield on the 10-year T-note rose to 3.72%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Reuters, the world's news and information source, working to make a difference every day. Before it's news, it's Reuters. Want more from Marketplace? It's all on our website. You can stream, download, or subscribe to podcasts of all our shows. And we have text of most stories, plus special reports and the Marketplace Toolbox. Check it out at marketplace.org.
From the Marketplace Statebook, here's a glance at events coming up Friday. In Washington, the U.S. Conference of Mayors wraps up its winter meeting. On January 25, 1905, the world's largest diamond was found in a South African mine. The Cullinan diamond was 3,106 carats. And some calendars reflect that it's Fun at Work Day. Put that in your BlackBerry. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdal. You know, it's not for nothing the stimulus package that was announced this morning bumps up the loan limits for Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac because real estate is still very much under the gun. The National Association of Realtors reported this morning sales of existing homes just wrapped up their worst year since 1982. This country's number two home builder, Lennar, announced its worst quarterly loss ever at about the same time. It kind of stands to reason this week's Fed rate cut will give the housing industry a shot in the arm, but we asked Marketplace's Steve Tripoli to find out for sure.
Nicholas Ritsinas at Harvard's Joint Center for Housing Studies says the rate cut's certainly not a bad thing.
Lower interest rates always help borrowers. The housing market is looking for borrowers.
People whose mortgage payments are adjusting might pay less. That could help them and others hold on to their homes, and more new buyers can join the game. But Retsina says for many of those folks, that only happens if there's money to be had.
It's not so much how much it costs to borrow, it's whether or not you can get someone to lend to you. And what the rate cut doesn't necessarily do is loosen the tightened credit that we now have, particularly to first-time home buyers, particularly to credit-impaired borrowers.
Call it double bubble trouble. Rate cuts alone have a hard time overcoming both a deflating housing bubble and a deflating credit bubble, because it's hard to help housing if credit's too tight. Thomas Lahr is an independent housing economist. He describes this week's rate cut this way.
It's clearly a net positive that will offset a portion of the massive number of negatives.
But Lahr says rate cuts can't bandage all the economy's wounds. He adds the huge inventory of unsold homes to housing's woes.
If you're looking for this drop in interest rates to stop the decline in housing markets where inventories are gargantuanly high and prices still haven't adjusted down to be consistent with income levels, that's a false hope.
So cheer that cut by all means, but don't think it's an express route to any promised land for housing or the economy. I'm Steve Tripoli for Marketplace.
I'm pretty sure the Fed didn't time it this way on purpose, but Tuesday's rate cut couldn't have come at a more opportune moment for the housing industry. January is traditionally the time of year when home sales pick up again after the holidays. That usually means swarms of real estate agents braving the weather out there, but not this year. The credit squeeze has made home loans harder to come by, so sellers are thinking twice before they put their places up for sale. Sally Herships met one couple that's trying to decide.
These days, the housing market feels like an overstocked grocery store with hardly any customers browsing the aisles. So it's easy to understand why homeowners are having trouble with the decision to add more inventory to the shelves.
I'm not sure we've even made the decision.
Diana Abu-Jaber and her husband, Scott Eason, are on the fence. In fact, they've been on the fence for 5 years, which is almost as long as they've owned their home.
We're sure we want to move, but we still are asking each other, well, should we?
I wouldn't describe it as a decision, as a conversation.
Yeah, that's good, conversation.
It's the matrix. We're in the move matrix.
Scott and Diana are both writers. They live in Coral Gables outside Miami.
We want more space. We want a bigger house.
Scott's priority is his home office. Right now, he works in a Florida room. For those of you who don't speak Floridian, that's a converted porch. He wants a real office, a bigger one, and he wants space for a boat. Diana, on the other hand, is worried about pulling up their roots. She considers their local friend's family, so she's torn about the idea of moving. And then there's the money.
I don't really want to take on additional debt in spite of what Diana says.
That's not a very exciting plan. No, my idea is to sell more books. I'm always thinking the next novel is going to do it.
Well, these are all variations on just saving the money.
Oh, that's true. But mine's more exciting
yours
than yours.
More exciting, yeah. Yeah.
While Diana and Scott debate, the market is melting underneath them. House values have fallen sharply in their community, but their spirits are still high.
As prices fall, yes, our house price falls too, but so does the one that we'll ultimately buy.
There aren't really any winners right now.
That's Professor Chris Mayer, director of Columbia University Center for Real Estate.
People think that, well, if house prices fall, that's bad for sellers and good for buyers. Well, it's not so simple.
Mayer says sellers are worse off because prices have fallen. And with lenders tightening terms on mortgages, it's tough to find buyers, whichever market you're in.
I don't think there's anywhere that's insulated when it's hard to get a mortgage.
But although the market forecast looks gloomy, Mayer says it's still possible to sell. But he says homeowners need to get an accurate read on the market first. Just looking at comparable sales won't do it. Mayer says the sale price of a house that closed today was probably decided 3 or 4 months ago.
So when prices are declining, people tend to overprice their house. And when prices are rising, people tend to underprice their house. What you really need to do is be forward-looking, not backward-looking.
Scott and Diana are looking forward to a complete market collapse, believe it or not. Scott says their house doubled in value in the first 2 years after they bought it, and their property taxes are so high that it's become almost too expensive to live in the house.
We have just a regular mortgage, you know, we did a regular down payment, and we pay more in taxes and insurance than we do on the principal of the loan.
Scott says he wouldn't mind even if the price of his home fell below purchase. He sees a flat market as a golden opportunity to bargain shop and to lock in manageable tax rates. That way, he hopes, he and Diana could afford the larger house they're dreaming of. I'm Sally Herships for Marketplace.
Most of the talk about housing has been aimed at helping homeowners who might have to make some tough choices. But there are people who've run out of options. The number of homeless in this country is rising as the economy deteriorates. That's prompted Washington to come up with a program called Housing First. It puts a priority on getting people off the streets and into homes. Commentator Brendan Kerner says Housing First is based on a tried and true business strategy, but the money could be better spent.
It's hard not to admire Phil Mangano. Inspired by St. Francis of Assisi, Mangano quit his lucrative music industry job a quarter century ago to dedicate himself to public service. He vowed to apply the skills he developed while negotiating record deals to wiping out homelessness. As President Bush's homelessness czar, Mangano's top priority has been Housing First. It's a strategy inspired by a fundamental business tool, cost-benefit analysis. According to Mangano, a mentally ill or drug-addicted homeless person who drifts through hospitals and jails can cost the government upwards of $150,000 per year. But simply renting that person an apartment lowers the annual tab to between $14,000 and $25,000. Best of all, 85% of participants in Housing First stay off the streets for good. Mangano's innovative program reduced chronic homelessness by 11.5% between 2005 and 2006. Supporters of Housing First say this decline has an important trickle-down effect for businesses located in areas where vagrants cause problems. But speaking strictly in financial terms, Mangano's approach may be a money loser over the long haul. Housing First deals only with a handful of single, deeply troubled adults. Meanwhile, with foreclosures soaring and wages stagnant, the number of homeless families is increasing. Take Massachusetts, where more homeless families are living in shelters than at any time since 1983. Nationwide, homeless families now account for over 40% of the overall homeless population. 32% of them are unable to find space in shelters. It's increasingly difficult for these families to find permanent accommodations. In San Francisco, for example, nearly 7% of the population is waiting for housing assistance. Advocates for the homeless blame government budget cuts. There are long-term financial costs to this problem. Homeless kids are less likely to finish school and become productive taxpayers. And homeless families are a drag on the resources of relatives who provide temporary food and shelter. By dedicating so many of his agency's resources to Housing First, Mangano has chosen a short-term payout over long-term investment. And that's no way to run a business.
Brendan Kerner is a contributing editor at Wired Magazine. He's a columnist for Slate, too. Send us your thoughts when you get a chance. We're online at marketplace.org.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, offering more of what you want in a retirement plan. Putnam Investments, a prudent approach to investing. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
This final note today, my paper was soaking wet when I went down to the end of the driveway this morning. We've been having all kinds of rain out here. No big deal, though. Just went inside and read it online. 60 million of you do the same thing. The Newspaper Association of America and Nielsen said today newspaper website readership was up 6% last year, and advertisers have noticed. Online ad revenue rose 21% in the third quarter. Print ads dropped 9%. It was a net loss to newspaper advertising revenue, though, down more than 7% overall. That is Marketplace for today from American Public Media. Today, the Dow bumped up a relatively boring 108 points, 8-tenths of 1%. The Nasdaq added 44 points, 9-tenths of 1%. The S&P 500 gained 11 points, 8-tenths of 1% there. Kevin Arnovitz, Patty Hirsch, Margaret Koval, Karen Lowe, Betsy Streisand, and Lisa Tucker are the Marketplace editing staff. The managing editor is George Judson. Coming up next time on the program, barren fields and failing crops in sub-Saharan Africa.
The soil is like a bank. If you keep drawing from your bank account, eventually you get a phone call from your manager. And that phone has been ringing incessantly in Africa for the last 15, 20 years.
I'm Kai Rizdal. Hope you can join us for that tomorrow.
American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.